This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporter Roundtable Thursday. We have a chance to check with some of the local media representatives to talk about the stories that they've offered up online as well as in print for the week. And then we include today in the Reporters Roundtable, John Gard, who is a reporter for the LaPorte Herald-Argus and the Michigan City News-Dispatch. And we'll also have Post-Tribune reporter Greg Tejeda. He covers news from around Gary and some interesting stories. We'll find out from him about that, too. We'll start things off, though, with a conversation with Howie Politics Indiana founder, editor, and publisher Brian Howie to talk about a number of topics involving politics in the state as well as around the country. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and from time to time we have a chance to talk with the fellow who created and still runs Howie Politics Indiana, Brian Howie. And Brian's down at the office in Indianapolis. Thank you for joining us today again.
Actually, I'm down here in Nashville.
Oh, you went to be down at headquarters HQ2, right?
Yeah. Yes, and literally, I was just chopping wood about 10 minutes ago. I got a fire going here. It's cold out.
Well, you know, it's cold out there. So I'm not surprised. Yeah, it's a chilly day up here in Northwest Indiana too. We just don't have any precip, and I guess it's gotten worse down your way there. Gotten chillier and damper, I understand too. So it's not surprising. I also understand too that I think that although I don't think she's officially said so, I know the state Representative Linda Lawson has alluded to the fact that she would like to look into having a place down in Nashville in Brown County someday. So you may get a neighbor down there. Who knows? We'll just wait and see what happens.
You know, I'll give her a call and invite her down, because I can stir around.
She had kind of mentioned that some time ago, I know. So maybe she's changed her mind, but I wouldn't doubt it. I know that she's busy, of course, with her final term of office in the State House, as is people like not only like Linda Lawson, but also like Charlie Brown and Gary and others as well, too, that have decided they're not going to run for re-election. That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about here. We're into the General Assembly, getting close to the end of this 2018 session. Have you, in keeping track with all that you knew, and I know there's a lot of it's on the national scene, which we'll talk about, too, during our conversation, but are there any surprises or disappointments that you've seen come out of the General Assembly this session?
I think it's gone pretty much, what a lot of people expected. I think the township consolidation, which doesn't really affect your area much, that may have been a kind of a disappointment. I know the Indiana Chamber's upset about the smoking age limit. And of course, we've got the Sunday, alcohol sales, although, you have to go to a liquor store to get cold beer. So that may be the other big missed opportunity. We've got the state takeover of schools in Gary and Muncie. I'm not sure if there's any major surprises there. So things kind of went according to script. I think one of the most important pieces of legislation coming out is something the governor is going to sign here in the next couple of days, and that's the registry for doctors to use to find out, who's getting what prescriptions here, and that's set up to, kind of put a crimp in the opioid epidemic that we're seeing in large swaths of the state.
Then we know too that the governor's also due to see the bill that's going to make some changes in the abortion regulations as well too. They're going to find that the doctors will have to report more to the state if they come across anything that their patients may have to report in, as far as having either had an abortion or some of the symptoms, I suppose, that may result from one.
Yeah, and, it's the what the governor is going to sign is the I think it's called the inspect thing, because a lot of addicts they'll game the system. They'll go to pharmacies in three or four different counties, and there hasn't been a reliable way in the past, for pharmacists to track, who's getting what where. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty significant piece of legislation.
If there was something that came about that hasn't yet, but may have already gone through to the governor's desk for review, what do you think might be the most important thing, or one of the most important things, maybe aside from the change in the liquor laws, I suppose, that may have come out of this session?
Well, the legislative priority for Speaker Brian Bosma and the chamber, Indiana Manufacturers. It's been all the workforce programs that have been spread out. I think there's like 30-some different programs spread out over 9 agencies. They spend a lot of money, you know, millions of dollars a year, and yet there was the perception that there was not a lot of coordination. And I think that may be the piece of legislation that makes the most news. It's still undergoing the process. It hasn't passed final. It's not to conferees yet. But everybody I've talked to, all the legislative leaders and the governor, thinks that's a pretty important piece of legislation. It's going to streamline the process. They've taken kind of an audit as to what's being spent where, and so that's the key piece of legislation that particularly in a manufacturing area like the region is that could have a real impact down the road.
I know, too, that we also noticed what some of the lawmakers have been doing. Some lawmakers that we were referring earlier to State Representative Linda Lawson, as well as State Representative Charlie Brown. And, of course, can't forget State Representative Scott Pelath. He's another who has decided he's not running for re-election. He's finishing up this session as his last in the General Assembly. And he'd already turned over the party mantle, party leadership mantle, rather, already. But he's trying to do his best, and he's gotten some measures through, I know, for the session here. What are your thoughts about some of these veteran lawmakers who have decided to decide not to run for re-election?
Well, there's been a real change of the guard, particularly, in the region, and that goes back to, the late Earl Harris passing away. We've seen quite a bit of change. So, yeah, you're gonna get some new faces. You got Senator Melton that is beginning to make an impact here. I think that the key thing, and there's 20 vacancies. 20 legislators have called it quits or have taken other jobs over the past year. The real key thing is, can the Indiana Democratic Party make some inroads in both the Indiana House and Senate? Because, that had to be frustrating for Linda and Charlie, to be in the minorities, such distinct super minorities. You just don't have much of an impact, as opposed to, either being in the majority or being close where you can actually have to negotiate and that kind of thing. And so this is an absolute crucial midterm election coming up here. If the Indiana Democrats can't make inroads, pick up 5 or 10 seats in the Indiana House and 5 or 6 in the Indiana Senate, there's only one more election before they draw the new maps in 2021. And if they can't get in the game, then we may be looking at a decade where it's essentially a one-party state, just kind of like it is right now. Yeah. And so it's pretty key. The Democrats have had a very good recruiting year. Compared to the last midterm election in 2014, they've recruited a lot of female candidates. That's up significantly. They have more seats that they're contesting. And I think they're hoping that, you have that anti-Trump wave beginning to take shape, although, who knows whether it's actually going to manifest itself or not. But this is an absolutely critical election for Indiana Democrats.
We're talking with Howie Politics Indiana creator and editor and publisher Brian Howie. And I'm glad you mentioned about how the state house races are going to shape up here as we go into the primary election, as well as what will happen in November in the election as well. We talk about the state house and the changes there. I mean, I know that even as far back as earlier this year, that people like Linda Lawson lamented the fact that it's only been one-party rule for an awful long time at the state house. We know also, too, that the Republicans are looking to being able to unseat Democrat U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly, and that's quite an interesting race, I understand. You've been keeping track of that very closely, I guess all of the different twists and turns almost every single day in Howie Politics Indiana, haven't you?
Yeah, we've got a fascinating Republican Senate race. It's a three-way race between the two reps, Todd Rokita, who's originally from Munster, Luke Messer, and then Mike Braun, the businessman, industrialist from Jasper. My sense is that may be like the 1998 Republican Senate race. I think any of the three can win it. I think it's It's a pure toss-up. In 1998, you had Paul Helmke, John Price, and Peter Rustoven running for the right to take on Evan Bayh. And I think Helmke won that nomination, but they were all bunched up. They were within 2 or 3% of each other on the final tally. And I would not be surprised if we see a similar situation here with the Republican Senate race.
What have been some of the things that have come out on the campaign trail that the Republican candidates have said or done that have gotten your earliest attention, I suppose, or the attention that's drawn the most, I guess, the most people reading not only your publication, but also talking about it?
Well, for the past decade, you've seen Todd Rokita and Luke Messer as members of Congress talk about the national debt and budget deficits and that kind of thing. They were true deficit hawks. And then when we get the tax reforms that were passed in December, you know, the Congressional Budget Office and other analysts say, you know, it's going to add the deficit's going to be, I think, $1.5 trillion. That's back to, you know, George W. Bush days. And I mean, it's like they've just forgotten all about that. I think in 10 years, they're projecting the budget deficits to be $2 trillion. And the problem with that is, you know, you got the baby boomers that are retiring. They're going to put a lot of stress on the system. They're going to have to reform Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And then when you're throwing all this national debt on, and this is without, you know, a significant recession or a depression or some kind of national disaster like a major earthquake or hurricane somewhere, we've got some real problems. And, you know, Mitch Daniels, the Purdue president, wrote a book called Keeping the Republic, in which he raised the alarm back in 2011 about the size of the national debt. I had a conversation with him about a month ago, and I asked him about, you know, the tax reform bill, and he said, you know, the road's getting shorter and the can's getting bigger, and they're just kicking this can down the road. Mm-hmm. So I think that's fascinating. And, you know, Joe Donnelly's watching this. I'm sure he's going to be raising that when it comes up when there's finally a nominee to run against him.
Speaking of the nominees, in fact, I know you and your fellow writers in the Howie Politics Indiana, one in particular I'm thinking of is Rich James, of course, who's a longtime Northwest Indiana political analyst. He's kept an eye on things, and he's one of, I think I counted one time, about 25 columns that are there on Howie Politics Indiana, and Rich has one that's out regularly, and I think one of his latest ones talks about Todd Rokita, and he kind of takes Todd to task for going in and bad-mouthing people that he probably shouldn't be right now.
Yeah. I mean, this past week he said that Gary was a sanctuary city. Mm-hmm. Apparently he had a conversation with Mayor Freeman Wilson in Washington recently, and he said he wasn't going to do that. So, you know, Rich thought that Rokita was kind of taking a cheap shot. And of course, but that kind of thing, you know, that may play well in a Republican primary where he's trying to appeal to, you know, the Trump voter, the rural Indiana voter who, you know, doesn't know much about Gary, doesn't know anything about it. And so that's, you know, it's typically what we call playing to the base, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. And Rokita's well known for that.
Well, we've talked here now about the candidates in the Republican Party for U.S. Senate to try to take Joe Donnelly's seat in Washington, and I know a lot. You spend a lot of time in the newsletter with your little atomic columns that come out on almost a daily basis, it seems, or at least five days a week to be sure, talking about the issues in Washington and the White House in particular, and a lot of, I know, comments. And you had a chance to take a look at what has already been said in the past about, about now Vice President Mike Pence. What are your thoughts from the things you've seen and you've kept track of about the transformation of Mike Pence from being Indiana governor to being a vice president?
Well, let's take it under the current hot topic, which is Trump is going to be signing these tariffs on steel and aluminum.
Right.
But, you know, obviously Congressman Visklovsky is pretty pleased about that, but You go over a couple counties, talk to Representative Walorski over in Elkhart, where, you know, a lot of the boat, our recreational vehicle manufacturers you know, use steel. We got the automakers and that kind of thing, and they're all looking at this and seeing prices rising. So that's a key thing. Now Republican congressmen and women have been complaining. Walorski wrote a letter to President Trump. They're saying, you know, this could damage the economy. It's going to step on the message of the tax reforms. Vice President Pence has been publicly supportive of these tariffs, although when he was a member of Congress and an Indiana governor, he was very much an ardent free trader. Mm-hmm. And Politico had a story yesterday saying that, you know, behind the scenes, Pence is trying to influence, you know, Trump to maybe make some changes or not to make the tariffs so broad. And then the column that I wrote this week is, you know, the impact on Indiana agriculture. I mean, just about every agriculture leader that I've talked to or read, from the wheat growers to corn growers, soybeans, you know, they're definitely fearful of retaliation. And there was a Reuters story in February where in the fourth quarter of 2017, Mexico import of Brazilian corn went up 970%. 970%. So they're starting to explore, you know, Argentine and Brazilian corn markets. And if you're an Indiana grain farmer down there in Newton or Jasper County, I mean, you're kind of freaked out about that.
Yeah, you ought to be worried, so, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So there's some real concern on that front. And there was some talk today about maybe exempting Canada and Mexico.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of a last minute thing. It all seems to be kind of, you know, the MO of the Trump White House seems to be, you know, fly by the seat of your pants, and decisions are made on a rash basis and not particularly well thought out. It's just got to be a fascinating experience for Mike Pence to have to be a part of this, and he's had to, you know, change his own personal stances in order to support the president. That's been absolutely fascinating.
Well, Brian, we're going to have you back on to talk in more detail here as things develop here in the months ahead. We do appreciate you spending time with us today talking about not only Hoosier politics, but politics on the national level, including some Hoosiers like Mike Pence. Brian Howie is the creator, and he's the editor and publisher of Howie Politics Indiana, and especially in particular, you can go online and check out some of the information on that and go pick up get yourself signed up for the newsletter itself and go into more detail with some of these topics, in particular about the Trump tariffs and the like. Brian, thanks for spending some time with us today. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's turn now to one of our reporters who's been keeping an eye on the events in particular in his county. John Gard is a reporter for the LaPorte Herald Argus and the Michigan City News Dispatch, and he has his finger on what is happening, at least in LaPorte County, and we're glad to have you with us today, John.
Hi, Chris.
One of the things I know that had prominently in the stories that you had published in the newspapers and what are online as well, too, is keeping track of what's happening with the LaPorte County Council. And they were taking care of a lot of business, I understand, this week in particular, some business that has an impact on veterans in the region.
Yeah, that's right. They had been asked to fund a satellite veteran service office, mm-hmm. In Michigan City. And there was a bit of wrangling about that, and they eventually decided after a third vote to partially fund it until a better case can be made for a second office in Michigan City.
Now, had there been one that had been opened up there in at least in LaPorte County, aside from the main office there at the courthouse?
Yeah, there's been a full-time office in LaPorte, the city of LaPorte, which is the county seat. But one of the commissioners, a veteran himself, Rich Mersinski, had been pressing for a satellite office to open 2 days a week in Michigan City, where there's a second courthouse, to serve all the veterans there. They had opened the office on a trial basis last summer and waited to see if their numbers supported that. He thought it did, and some of the council members thought it, the numbers did not necessarily show a need for that.
Okay. Now, in doing your research on this, as well as covering the LaPorte County Council meeting and looking into how veterans are best served in LaPorte County, what kind of impression do you get from what you've seen and talked to people about? Is the service that the Veteran Service Officers or the offices, I should say, are offering to residents who really need that help?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely, the veterans are in favor of having an office in Michigan City, so they don't have to drive to LaPorte every time they need something.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of the veterans, especially the older veterans, that's you know, that the transportation can be an issue. And then, of course, the commissioner, he looks to some other counties in Indiana that have similar populations of veterans, and they have more than one veteran service officer. And so he's really making the case that I think there are 10,000 veterans in LaPorte County that need service. So he's been pressing that case.
One of the other stories that you had as well, too, involving the LaPorte County Council here recently, it was talking about a project there at the Michigan City Courthouse. What's the status on that right now?
The council has given its authorization to proceed with that project that involves an expansion, nearly doubling of the size of the Michigan City Courthouse, as well as some renovation to the courthouse itself, the existing courthouse, which was built back in 1909, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So the need for that has gone back quite a ways.
Yeah, I know it's very small, and I guess it's probably the first impression that one would get them. You travel into Michigan City, and you look for something that looks like a courthouse. You see it, but it isn't very big, but it does, I guess, indicative of how business was back there at the turn of the 20th century, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, and there was a small electrical fire in January, and that really brought the issue into focus.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, because they knew that there was a need for some upgrades, and that really just put an exclamation point on it.
Now, as far as the project is coming along here, I'm sure they would like to get things started as soon as they can, but I guess there's a question, if you know more about this than I, about on how this project's going to be funded. That's a big question right now, I understand.
Yeah, and the issue that came up last week was that the county had looked at all of its facilities and looked at the Michigan City Courthouse project as an important one, but also there's a courthouse in the city of LaPorte. This is one of the few counties where there are two historic courthouses to maintain, mm-hmm. and they both need work and expansion. So the issue among the council is whether to authorize work on both of them or just the Michigan City one. But in the end, they decided just to proceed with the Michigan City project for now and worry about the LaPorte project later.
I know that one of the other big stories that you had in the newspapers here recently was dealing with the Kingsbury Industrial Park. We've had some stories here off and on about that, and I know you mentioned a few, too, about improvements that they're making at the Industrial Park to position the park for even more business and dealing with not only improving the rail service into the park, but other things, too. And I guess the latest thing is dealing with the electrical service. How is NIPSCO getting involved in the project now?
Yeah, NIPSCO is interested in upgrading service to the industrial park by putting new and much larger poles in and new transmission lines for electrical service. Some of those materials date back 70 years almost to it's a former World War II era munitions plant.
Right. One of the things I know in the story you well, too, you talked not only about what NIPSCO is like to do here, too. You can bring us up to date, too, on how the efforts to bring more business into the industrial park is coming along. That's been something, I guess, that's been going on for quite some time.
Yeah, it's an ongoing issue. It's really, I mean, to hear everyone talk, it's really ripe for investment now. And with the investment, I think NIPSCO had planned $6 million to improve some of the infrastructure down there, which is kind of a big deal. And then NIPSCO had also, in a separate rate case, had agreed to spend $3.5 million on any kind of service or upgrading of service that might be needed in case there is a large development that comes to the industrial park.
Have you heard anything in talking with your sources there in LaPorte County about any companies that are at least thinking about locating, if they haven't done so already, into the Kingsbury Park?
Yeah, you know, it seems all the time that they're saying, you know, we're so close that, you know, we're in conversations every day with one company or another or some developer. But, of course, they're always tight-lipped about it because right. They can't reveal any information until there's an announcement ready to be made. So it really sounds like they're on the verge of something, but we just have to kind of wait and see.
Okay. John Gardner's reporter for the LaPorte Herald-Argus, as well as the Michigan City News-Dispatch. He covers news in LaPorte County for the newspapers, in print and online as well, too. And as always, John, thank you for spending some time with us today to talk about the stories, and we hope to have you back on soon.
Thank you, Chris.
Continuing on with Regionally Speaking is the Reporter Roundtable Thursday. Let's check in with Greg Tejeda. He covers news around the area, including the city of Gary, for the Post-Tribune. As always, Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I understand it was a very interesting Gary Common Council meeting recently that involved a lot of young people coming in. Tell us what was all about and what was talked about.
Well, about two school buses filled with students, more than 200 students in the Steel City Academy, who are facing the prospect of having a, as they refer to it, a waste dump, is the phrase they always prefer to use, built within 96.4 feet from their front door. And they don't like the idea of that. So the students, some of the parents, the faculty, they showed up at the Common Council meeting that was held Tuesday night, and they made sure that the council got the message that they do not want this being built there.
Now, Maya Energy is got this project. They've been working on it, I guess, maybe more behind the scenes, I suppose, than anything else here for about a year, haven't they?
Yes. And, in fact, one council member, LaVita Sparks-Wade, Amy Gary, told me that she's now seeing this, that they were possibly misled about what this project was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
That they were, her impression was that this was going to be some sort of recycling center,
yeah. You know,
aluminum. And now they're hearing solid waste, and some of the council members are talking about wanting to revisit the issue and renegotiate and try to clarify exactly what's going to be done here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that I remember in the beginning when they first made mention that they were what they were going to be doing in Gary, that they talked about a materials resource recovery facility, which basically just means that clean material is coming in the front door and it's getting sorted and going into the proper places, the balers or wherever it's going on the other end. So that's this sounds a little bit different this time, doesn't it?
Right. Basically, I get the feeling some people just aren't too sure what's being done. So they, like the one council member said, they need to clarify exactly.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to be done, and this is probably going to be a topic of conversation for the next few months.
Now, tell us what the students are fearing that they're facing, being just across the street from where this proposed site is.
They hear dump, they hear waste, they're afraid it's going to be garbage, they're afraid it's going to be contaminants.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid it puts their health at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And as one student actually told me at the rally, you know, we have other things in life we ought to be worrying about instead of having to worry about our health being at risk.
And I know, too, this is proposed along 35th Avenue, and that's a pretty busy area anyway. It's close to the Borman Expressway, I'm sure, and that's enough problems with pollution from the trucks and everything else that makes the trek on the highway. I'm sure that would just add to the problems in the neighborhood, wouldn't it?
I'm always wary of complaining about pollution in Gary. The whole area at times gets a little too... It's just a fear, you know, everywhere.
Yeah, that's understandable. So, well, what is the procedure that you're aware of now, I guess, if this hasn't officially gotten, I guess, State Environmental Protection Agency approval, has it?
Not yet. You know, it's on hold, and this is going to be a pending issue. You know, it's, mm-hmm. We're going to be, you know, I'm going to be watching that. I'm sure you'll be watching this very closely over the next few months to see what direction this takes.
Okay. Well, Greg, besides the issues involving the Maya Energy project and the reaction of the residents and the students that go to school in the area as well, too, you also tell us about some concern that the neighborhoods have had, I guess, about making sure that the right things are told about how the history of Gary goes. And I understand that there's some neighborhoods that have gotten involved in the city's preservation tour. Tell us about that.
Yes, they did their first preservation tour last year, which focused on downtown Gary, this business strip of Broadway, all the old buildings that have, in some cases, become decrepit, but still have a certain uniqueness. They're going to do the tour again this summer, And this time they're going to expand it a little bit broader. Instead of just focusing on Broadway, they're going to be out in the Horace Mann and the Morningside neighborhoods, which are the areas just adjacent to downtown Gary. Mm-hmm. Some of the homes there are old enough, older, go back pretty close to the beginning of the creation of Gary.
Wow.
And they're trying to create the image, you know, that this is potentially a community with a historic value to it, not just a bunch of decrepit old buildings that need to be torn down.
And I know, too, that there's, of course, the next next piece of work that's about to be done for preservation purposes, and as well as other uses, as well as the former City Methodist Church. And I know the city's getting involved in that project, too. Tell us the latest about that.
They actually got grants several months ago. They've been doing architectural studies to determine just exactly what physical condition the structure is in. I mean, we're talking about a building where technically the roof collapsed a long time ago. Mm-hmm. It's the outer walls that stand. And in some places, this building is totally overgrown, you know, with wildlife. But some city officials see this and think this is an opportunity. You know, this wild overgrowth, maybe this is something people would want to see. You know, maybe you can reinforce the structure a little bit so that people can safely walk in there and see all this overgrowth. And mm-hmm. you know, it can be something beautiful to photograph, you know, get in there. I know when our photographers have been able to get in there, you know, they've come up with some real unique shots.
Mm-hmm. I understand that there's supposed to be a workshop coming up here soon, or at least a presentation about what the people that have been working on the project have to say. That's coming up pretty...
March 22nd, yeah. It'll be at the offices of the Gary Redevelopment Commission, 504 North Broadway. Their point is they want to let the public come in, try to explain to them exactly what it is they're doing, because I don't know, I think some people are confused about the idea of an old decrepit church being opened up again. Yeah, they want to try to explain it, put on a big show, sway the people over to thinking this is a wonderful idea. It'll be March 22nd, and they're hoping the public will turn out.
And Greg, finally here, let's talk about, I guess, the latest effort the City of Gary is making to help young people in the community be able to have the opportunity to better their lives, better their education as well, too. The next round of funds coming from the city, I guess, is going, with some help, I guess, from Majestic Star Casino, going to help out on funding some scholarships. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Majestic Star Casino provided some money to the ICER Foundation out in Merrillville, which is using the money. It's going to run the scholarship program for Gary City residents. The intent, I believe it's $100,000 they have for this first year. They're going to try to come up with a way of providing money to Gary residents who have the prospect to go to college and need the money. As of now, the city officials have talked with school officials to try to identify prospective students, you know, who could use the money. And the city officials are also planning some sort of a public rally on March 16th. It's going to be the idea is they're going to promote this program, let the students know that this scholarship money is available, let them know how to apply if they're interested. And the idea is they're not sure, city officials aren't sure how much these scholarships are going to be worth.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to be $100,000 for the first year, and they'd actually like to split this thing up among as many students as possible. But then you get into the problem, if you split it up too small, is it going to be not enough to really benefit anyone? So they're still trying to figure out the balance of how much can they give to each student as opposed to how many students can they benefit.
Yeah. So it sounds like
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like they've got some more work ahead here to be able to get this, to give the most benefit to the young people that will actually get the scholarships in.
Definitely. I mean, they're not about to start giving out checks to anyone. Yeah. This is going to take some time for them to work out probably throughout the spring months.
Well, as long as they can get the money available to the students when they need it the most, when it's time to start signing up for college classes and paying for the classes this fall, I'm sure they probably like to be able to get the scholarships to good use by then, to be sure. We're talking with Greg Tejeda, who covers news in the city of Gary for the Post-Tribune, and thank you, as always, for being with us, and we appreciate your help today.
Thank you.
The explosion of the internet in the last few years in particular have made it so much easier for Hoosiers to find out information about their particular counties on a number of different topics. And the state government is helping out as well, too, by offering that information. It's making it available through the systems. And at IUPUI in Indianapolis, the Indiana University Business Research Center is able to put all this together into a special website, which is called Stats Indiana. And to talk more about Stats Indiana, we have the curator of Stats Indiana with us, Carol Rogers, Deputy Director of the IU Business Research Center. She's also the Chief Information Officer, and she's joining us from her office in Indianapolis. Carol, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thank you so much. Happy to participate with you, and I come from the region.
Well, that's good. That's nice to do that.
Absolutely. So I grew up in La Porte.
Well, that's certainly the part of us, and we have listeners in La Porte and members as well in La Porte, and we appreciate all their help as well, too. And we thought that this would be a great opportunity, at the very least, to explain in particular how Northwest Indiana residents can take advantage of Stats Indiana and learn something about the region in particular. If you will first, Carol, kind of explain how Stats Indiana got started.
It actually got started back in the early 1970s, believe it or not. This was a bit before my time with the research center, but our center has actually been around since 1925. We were one of the first research centers at Indiana University and the first one in the School of Business. And our mission has always been to study the people and economies of Indiana. So, of course, in order to do that, you have to collect data. And by the early 1970s, we had transferred much of the data we collected about the economy and population and building permits and housing data. We loaded it all onto an IBM computer and made it available through public libraries during the 70s and early 80s. Mm-hmm. And then by the early 90s, we translated everything to the internet, to what they used to call the World Wide Web.
Yes, that's right. That's right. When you got this information, the raw data that you basically had, what sources did you have to go to, or did I should say the center have to go to, actually, to be able to go through this and in turn, at that time, put it into the computer, and now, which is part of Stats Indiana? What sources do you go to for the data, and in what form do you have it?
Well, back in the day, we had people who actually did data entry. Back in the 70s and 80s, we translated it all by typing it in to the computer and storing it. Nowadays, we get things almost entirely through other digital files from the Census Bureau, National Center for Health Statistics, National Center for Education Statistics, a whole host of federal agencies, as well as state agencies like the Budget Agency, Department of Revenue, State Department of Health, Department of Education, you name it. We work with those state agencies to get data. And we also have built up special relationships with local governments to get data. We try to get as much tax data as possible. And so we have built up, really now our website says 5 billion plus data records. We're up to 12 billion. Now, because it just keeps, these data are like rabbits.
Wow.
They multiply.
I noticed that on the website, you talk in more detail here, not only about the fact that it's, I guess, basically Indiana's official digital data center, but also you offer up some interesting data stories, too. How do these data stories get put together?
We actually power our research with data transformed through technology. That sounds pretty fancy, doesn't it? But
yeah.
we try to maximize the use of the technology to help us analyze the information that we have so that we can put together stories about, for example, the economic impact of opioid addiction in our state, or trying to understand specific types of industry sectors or clusters of industry. We do a lot of work in the area of workforce development, and underpinning a lot of this is one of our long-term specialties, which is really population, understanding how many people do we have in our counties and regions of the state. And we're getting ready to release in a couple of weeks our latest series of population projections by age for all of our counties. And I think folks are particularly interested in that because we want to know where we're headed, especially if we don't do anything.
I know in one recent report within the last few months or so, we came out with a report on talking about population, and you went through the data, and we took note as well, too, on how the population of some of the communities in Lake County have grown, and it's kind of shown how the migration of people have been from one region to the other. For example, in Lake County, how some of the people that used to live in North Lake County in communities like Maryville, even Hammond and Highland and the like, or Whiting, how many of them have shifted now to South Lake County. They're living either out in the country or they're living in communities like Lowell or even Crown Point, for that matter, too, and Cedar Lake. They've taken advantage of the opportunities to move out in the open country, so to speak, and you note how the population shifts have been that way, too. Some of that earlier data is out there, so it'll be interesting to see how we translate that into some updates here with this new material coming out.
Yeah, and certainly one of the previews that I can give you prior to our release is that actually in our projections we see particularly strong growth for Porter and Jasper, which may interest a lot of people. I don't know that Porter County is necessarily surprised, but with Jasper County, certainly there's been a lot of both economic activity and residential development. And we get a lot of people who move into the region from the Chicago area.
That would be interesting to see how the data has really followed through on what we actually get to see. We see more houses and more people moving into communities and how communities are growing. Do communities in particular have the opportunity to use this data to be able to project what they need to do, not only for economic development, but to be able to deal with the problems that they're going to face if they're not facing them already, but when they have a higher population?
Certainly, what Stats Indiana can do is give you the numbers and the trends. You know, trend lines are really critical. We always stress looking at the data over time to see where a particular place is going. And with those trend lines, you can also then try to compare yourself to other parts of the state or even the country, because Stats Indiana provides data through its USA counties and profile for every county in the nation.
Wow.
So all 3,100 of those counties. And you can compare yourself to other places that may be similar to you but may be experiencing either high growth or a sharp decline and try to figure out why. Telling people, Stats Indiana isn't going to tell you what to do, but it can give you data about what others may have done to turn their trends around.
Right. Well, that's very important because, yeah, you say you're looking, everyone's looking for some examples so they can come up with some ideas where it may have worked someplace else and they can try to see if they can apply it to a local situation, that's to be sure. We're talking with Carol Rogers, who's the Deputy Director and the Chief Information Officer for the IU Business Research Center, which is based at IUPUI. And one of the projects that they work on, among several, is one that's available to anybody right now on the Internet by going onto the Stats Indiana website. It's billed as Indiana's official digital data center. And it's a great way to very easily, as you say, get the information for Indiana communities and counties, but also branch out to any community in the country, I would imagine, too. You've set it up on the website for different things that we've kind of mentioned about the data stories, and you mentioned one in particular that's available too. And you also talk about the very popular topics. And obviously, I'm sure over the years that the folks there at the center have discovered through the data and the statistics that you put out there that there are some things that people want to know the most about, and you've kind of broken it down into popular topics, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. And what's been trending recently is our school district data and township data. And certainly for schools, for school corporations, and we also equate that into county-level data, especially for economic developers and realtors, but understanding how our schools are doing is always important. We have an interactive map that you can go to for the school data, and then also the township data and the county profiles are really popular.
I mentioned in particular this General Assembly session has had some issues that have come up, and bills have been proposed and reviewed involving such things as figuring out how redistricting should be done, in particular the size of townships, and talking about finding ways to consolidate townships across the state. So I'm sure that the information, I'm sure at one point in time probably came to hand in the lawmakers that came up with these bills, and they had this opportunity to put all this together.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because we have population data going all the way back to 1900.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go in and again, because we're really big on those trends, which way are we headed, and you can look at township population or city and town population or county population, really over the past 11 decades worth of information that you can look at. And we try to go back in time as far as possible.
Now, it looks like it's easy to be able to get the information by going through the website. Give us, if you will, the address if people want to go online and look all this information up, how they can reach the Stats Indiana website.
Well, probably the easiest thing to do is just go to Google and type in Stats Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
The address, though, is www.stats.indiana.edu.
Well, it's very simple in itself there. It would be easy to put that up, and it's very graphic and easy to see on the screen and also easy to understand and to access as well, too. And we thank you very much, Carol Rogers, for explaining what Stats Indiana is all about, and look forward to for more people to take advantage of the opportunity to go online at the Stats Indiana website, find out whatever they happen to be interested in, and get the data that goes back so many years and learn more about the Hoosier State, to be sure.
Maybe we can get together again sometime, and we'll talk to you about our Gateway for Indiana Government Units.
Yes, I'd like to very much, because there are a number of things that the IU Business Research Center works on for Hoosiers, and this Stats Indiana website is just one of them. We will do so. Thank you very much, Carol, for being with us today. Carol Rogers is the Deputy Director and the CIO for the Indiana Business Research Center, based in Indianapolis. Several Indiana counties are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars every year to repair major road damage, and the source of some of these problems presents a rather unique challenge. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us that horseshoes that Amish communities use are especially hard on the pavement.
As you drive through Elkhart County, it's not unusual to pass several horse-drawn buggies on the road.
We have a buggy plate that we sell every year. We sell about 3,040 buggy plates, so that's a lot of buggies.
That's Elkhart County Commissioner Mike Yoder. We're standing on the side of a county road that has a long line of large divots spanning the entire block. And when a car or buggy goes over that broken pavement, it sounds just as bad as it feels. Yoder says the repeated impact of the horseshoe hitting the pavement causes what are called horse troughs to form in the roads.
Every time this slaps against the asphalt, it just chips out a little bit of asphalt. And that's what begins to create that space that water can infiltrate, and then we get the freezing and thawing, and the road breaks up.
I spoke to several members of the Amish community, but they didn't want to do recorded interviews. One of them specializes in horseshoes and says the abrasive material is necessary to prevent horses from slipping on wet roads. It's especially important in this part of the state, which gets a significant amount of snow every year. But Yoder says at least half of Elkhart County's roads have some sort of horseshoe damage. Paying to repair those roads is expensive. The costs are only partially covered by the county's $55 buggy plate fee.
But that generates maybe $140,000, $150,000 a year. And when we repave a mile of road, that's close to $100,000. So, you know, we can't do a lot of work.
4.5 hours south of Elkhart County, another community is facing a similar dilemma. Orange County is home to a smaller number of Old Order Amish. Richard Dixon is president of the Orange County Commissioners. He says horseshoe damage has always been a problem, but recently it's getting worse.
With the new Indiana Crossroads grants, we're doing a lot more hot mix asphalt paving, and I think the damage is even more pronounced on the hot mix asphalt.
County leaders here met with members of the Amish community to come up with solutions that would work for both parties. The Amish agreed to use less abrasive horseshoes for half of the year and use heavy-duty versions during the remaining months.
We've talked about rubber shoes. The problem with rubber shoes are that they don't last long. They don't wear well.
Yoder says leaders could consider similar options back up in Elkhart County to help reduce wear and tear on roads. But additional restrictions come with a different set of challenges.
Our county sheriff has been reluctant to pull over buggies and lift a horse's foot to check on the horseshoes.
Yoder says the Amish are such a big part of Elkhart County, people living here are used to their customs and traditions. He sees this as just another part of learning how to coexist. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And a special thanks today for talking with Brian Howey of Howey Politics Indiana, and for our reporters during Reporters Roundtable Thursday, to John Gard with the Herald Argus and the News Dispatch in LaPorte County, and to Greg Tejeda with the Post Tribune. And coming up in the days ahead on Regionally Speaking, we'll bring you conversations with Jeff Brown, who is, of course, the founder and the director of the Valparaiso University Jazz Festival. They have another event coming up here in April, and we'll find out more about the artists that are going to be coming to Valparaiso to perform, as well as the students who will be attending through their bands that they have from their high schools. And we'll also have with you, for you this week, coming up, a conversation with that Sharon Jackson had about the upcoming concerts and other programs on the schedule for this summer's 2018 Festival at Ravinia. All that coming up this next few days on Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte, and we hope you'll join us.